We look very much look forward to Uncle Brian dealing with the last part of chapter 43, and he's taken from verse 25 as his title for tonight, "I am he that blotteth out thy transgressions." In the 43rd chapter, just to pick up the threads, there was an unparalleled statement in verses 1 to 7 of God's intimate relationship with Israel. He created him, Jacob, verse 1. He formed him, Israel. "I have redeemed thee, I have called thee by my name, thou art mine." And those first seven verses are really an unparalleled expression of God's intimate love and relationship with the children of Jacob. He would give other nations, verse 3, for them. "Every one that is called by my name," verse 7, "is going to come. Whether he's been found spread in the east," verse 5, "or the west," or "the north," or "the south." Expressions that are based, weren't they, upon Deuteronomy chapter 30, when it said that they would, having been scattered into all winds, they would be gathered from the four winds of heaven. And here they are. "I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back." You remember that Jeremiah made expressions of a similar kind in Jeremiah chapter 16. Therefore the days come, verse 14 of Jeremiah 16, saith Yahweh, "that it shall no more be said, Yahweh liveth, that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt. But Yahweh liveth, that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north and from all the lands whither he hath driven them. And I will bring them again into their land that I gave unto their fathers." So Jeremiah in several passages will reiterate that theme which here is stated by Isaiah. And then you remember coming back to Isaiah 43 in the next two verses, there was a call to the nations to be converted by prophecy fulfilled. And he challenges them. He said, where's your evidence? Let them bring forth the evidence that they can speak of things of the future. Where have they spoken and it has been fulfilled? And of course, there was nothing that the nations could bring forth. And we mentioned last week the peculiar nature of being able to forecast the future. That none of us know, even in our personal lives, do we, just what might be upon the morrow. And so this was a powerful statement, acute argument to the nations as to the supremacy of Yahweh, the God of Israel. But now he says, verse 10, "There is a people who witness to my ability to declare former things and to bring them to pass. So verse 10, Israel is Yahweh's witness. Now the heading I had for verses 10 to 13, did I give it to you last time? I didn't, thanks Beck. Verses 10 to 13, Israel, it's a bit long but it gets the thought. Israel through Yahweh's revelation, is his witness, or are his witnesses, whichever you like. Of his unique wisdom and strength. They knew. Do you want me to repeat that? Israel through Yahweh's revelation, that's important, are his witnesses of his unique Godhead or his unique wisdom and strength. Israel's position was different. The nations were in ignorance, but Israel weren't. Not only could they provide evidence of a God that could tell the future, but they were also, in the great part, ignorant of the real and living God of Israel. But Israel were not. They were privileged and chosen, just so that they might, as he says in verse 10, that ye may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Now they are the difference, the different positions of Israel as compared to the Gentile. That ye may know and believe me and understand that I am he. They were not like the ignorant world of the Gentiles. They had knowledge through Yahweh's revelation. And so having that knowledge, they were able to see what God had done and therefore to link it with what he had said. They had the grounds of faith. They could see that that's what God said and that's what he's done. So you are my witnesses, because they knew, therefore greater responsibility was upon them. So verse 12, I have declared and have saved and I have showed when there was no strange God among you. Therefore ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am God. I have declared and have saved. Where did he declare and save? In particular, Deuteronomy 28, yes. And even a little before that. This is particularly, just keep your hand in Isaiah 43. It's particularly Exodus, isn't it? Exodus 3 and Exodus 6. And Deuteronomy 28 will follow, as Dan's intimated. That will follow shortly after. But it's particularly this, because whilst you've still got one hand in Isaiah 43, notice that in verse 11 it says, I, even I, am Yahweh, and beside me there is no Saviour. I, even I, am Yahweh, and beside me there is no Saviour. Now when did he indicate that he was Yahweh? Well, of course, it was in Exodus chapter 3. And there he said, in verse 12, certainly I will be with thee, and this shall be a token unto thee that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain. Verse 8, having seen their affliction, he said, I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land unto a good land, large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. Did he do it? Did he say he would? Did he declare? He did declare. He said, I am come down to deliver. I will be with thee, and you'll serve God in this mountain. Did he say it? Yes, he did say it. Did he do it? Yes, he did do it. So there he declared and he showed and he did it. In Exodus chapter 6, this passage in particular reveals Yahweh as the redeeming God. In Exodus 6, again, it has relationship to the giving of his name, verse 2, and God spake unto Moses and said unto him, I am Yahweh. This is a name now which they had heard before, but now they're going to see it in action. It was going to be fulfilled in a way they'd never appreciated it before. I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name El Shaddai, but by my name Yahweh was I not known to them. They knew the name, but they had not seen it in revelation. So that's a pertinent passage, isn't it? I've declared, I've showed, I've done it. Here's a pertinent passage, because here he's declaring that he is Yahweh, the God who will come to that nation. And so he says in verses 6 to 8, and these are key words to Isaiah 43, wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am Yahweh. Now what does that mean? It means this, and I will bring you out from under the burden of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm, there's our word redeem, and with great judgments. And I will take you to me for a people, there's a word in our Isaiah 43. I will be to you a God, And ye shall know that I am Yahweh your God, which bringeth you out from under the burden of the Egyptians, and I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to give it to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, and I will give it to you for an heritage. I am Yahweh. What does Yahweh mean? Yahweh means that he's going to redeem that people by his own resolute determination, his strength and his wisdom and power to do so. And he proclaimed it and he did it. On the basis of that, Israel, therefore, are his witnesses. They were the subject of it. So they had seen it indeed. So Exodus 3 and Exodus 6 are the really relevant passages to fit in here alongside Isaiah 43 and verse 12. Now, Daniel mentioned Deuteronomy chapter 28. These are the principal passages upon which such statements are based. Now, does everybody know what Deuteronomy chapter 28 is about? What's it about, Greg? Good, yeah. Blessings and cursings upon Israel. And it's a long chapter. It's got 68 verses in it. And it records the history of Israel before it happened. It tells them the blessings if they obey. It tells them the cursings if they don't. It tells them about the king they'll have, the king they'll lose. But captivity they'll go into, how they'll lose their own city, and how there'll be a siege, and what will happen in the siege, and so on. Tremendous chapter, right? There it all is. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, the history. So when God said, I have declared and have saved and I have showed, it was true, wasn't it? It was all written. Their record was faithfully given to them before the event. Now, you are my witnesses. Come a little bit further along in Moses' words after Deuteronomy 28. You see, all of this these are the basic chapters upon which the statements in Isaiah 43 are based. You are my witnesses? Why? Well, because you were the one that received it. You were the one that understood it. You were one who knew and believed and understood that I am he. And here's the grounds for that. In Deuteronomy now, chapter 32, and 31 firstly, 31 verse 19. Now therefore write ye this song for you, and teach it the children of Israel, put it in their mouths, that this song may be a witness. Ah, there's the word. For me against the children of Israel. That was the very reason, not the only reason, but it was one key reason why God gave that song. So that Israel would know it and later on they'd be able to record it. So we failed. God said this, he's done it. And that statement is repeated and repeated through this section. Verse 21. It shall come to pass, when many evils and troubles have befallen thee, that this song shall testify against them as a witness. Nations didn't know it. They couldn't stand up and say anything about the future, or what God has said about the future. But Israel could, my word. Verse 26. Take this book of the law and put it in the side of the ark of the covenant of Yahweh your God, that it may be therefore a witness against thee. So Deuteronomy chapter 32 and other sections became particularly relevant to the expression, ye are my witnesses. Now if you just go back to Isaiah chapter 43, keeping your hand in Deuteronomy meanwhile, it says there in verse 12, I have declared and have saved and I have showed when there was no strange God among you. Now that little phrase has its own echo. Do you remember where that comes from? Very relevantly. Where might you guess it might come from, Anthony? Deuteronomy, that's right. It's going to come from Deuteronomy chapter 32. So you're right in the context again. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, he says in verse 16, they provoked him to jealousy with strange gods. With abominations provoked they him to anger. They sacrificed unto devils, not to God, to gods whom they knew not, strange gods, to new gods that came newly up, whom your fathers feared not. That's going to be a statement of their future history. But he says, I have declared and have saved, and I have showed when there was no strange God among you. Before you did all that, I said what would happen. So it can't be, you know what I'm saying, can't have come from somewhere else. It can't have come from some other fountain of wisdom, because there weren't any such related to you at that time. You and I were there together, and I spoke the words. And so he's jealous of that which he has proclaimed. As he said over in Isaiah 42, verse 8, I am Yahweh, that is my name, and my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. Don't attribute to graven images that which I have spoken about. I am jealous for mine own name's sake. Don't attribute to Beelzebub that which has been granted by the Spirit of God. And that becomes the basis of the inflamed feeling that the Lord Jesus had when his generation did exactly that. So, completing then that little bracket, he says in verse 12 again, therefore, ye are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am God. So those passages, therefore, have a very strong bearing in a very definite area. That I am God. And, of course, the word God there is the word Ael. It means more than just God. It means that I am strength. You are my witnesses, saith Yahweh, that I am strength. And just a little note you might like to make. Where you have the word Ael, you'll almost always find that it will go back to Exodus 15, to the deliverance from the Egyptians through the Red Sea. Just make a little note of that in your mind or in your margin. Almost always, where you see Ael, you'll find there'll be a connection with that thought, because that's where it was first used, and that connotation flows. You get sections like Psalm 77 and Psalm 78, where you get a lot of references to Ael, and you'll find that's all founded on those earlier statements right back there in Exodus 15. Now verse 13 says, yea, before the day was, I am he. And there is none that can deliver out of my hand. I will work, and who shall let it? That's all a bit difficult to know exactly what that's saying, isn't it? The interlinear translation has, instead of before the day was, from this day I am he. And there is none that can deliver out of my hand. He was the only true God in history, and he remains so. From this day onwards, as he has proven it to this present time, so he proves it again, and he will be the living and true Ael from this day onwards. No break in the proceedings, no change of prime mover. God is the one who has fashioned history. He will determine the future. I will work, and who shall hinder it? As the word let means in the Old English, let had that very sense of hinder or restrain. I will work, and who shall hinder? Pharaoh thought that he would hinder God, didn't he? He thought that he would stop God from taking Israel out of that land, and he thought it 10 times, but he couldn't do it. And in the end, they came out of that land jubilant and loaded with the wealth that the Egyptians had placed upon them. I will work, and who shall hinder it? Now in verses 14 to 17, we have a little bracket which I have entitled, Yahweh, your Redeemer. They're very beautiful words. They really are. And they're very emotional words. There's a sort of growing crescendo in these words. just remember that everybody knew the history. He didn't have to tell them the history. He's saying it again because of its emotive power, its beauty, pulling them back to the ties from which they came. Thus saith Yahweh of Israel, your Redeemer. That's who he is. That's who he was in Exodus 6. Thus saith Yahweh, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, unique and wonderful God of Israel. It's a personal relationship that they have with him. You know, those phrases are repeated and repeated through this section. Chapter 44, verse 6. Thus saith Yahweh, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts. Beautiful expressions. Verse 24, Isaiah 44. Thus saith Yahweh, thy Redeemer, and he that formed thee from the womb, I am Yahweh that maketh all things. So we've already had it in our chapter, 43 and verse 1. I have redeemed thee, verse 1. And again in verse 3, I gave Egypt for thy ransom, for thy redemption, Ethiopia and Seba for thee. So there's a great concentration of thought upon that. He's appealing to Israel that redemption's not going to come from some other place. That Yahweh, your Holy One, he indeed is your Redeemer. Don't walk away from him. Come near to him because he's got all that you need for life and life eternal. So there's a growing crescendo in these verses. See again verse 15. I am Yahweh, your Holy One. See, repeating it again. Your Holy One, your Holy One, the Creator of Israel, your King. They're beautiful words, aren't they? You know, it is a wonderful thing that God should speak to a nation like that, isn't it? I mean, there's no other nation he's ever spoken to like that. What if it was to Australians? Just imagine if Yahweh was known to Australians like that. If in somewhere in Canberra there was a place that had his name there. How remarkable that would be. And what Australians would think, wouldn't they, of themselves, whether they won the Davis Cup or not. They'd think they were a marvellous nation, wouldn't they? Absolutely remarkable nation. They had God to themselves, as it were. And God came to the nations out of them. They boast in all sorts of things today. But my word, wouldn't it be an incredible thing? That's what Israel had. And these were very, very wonderful statements. I am Yahweh, your Holy One, Creator of Israel, your King. So there's a growing crescendo in these comments. Verse 14, he says, for your sake I have sent to Babylon and have brought down all their nobles. Who's Babylon? Who's their nobles? And the Chaldeans, whose cry is in the ships. Has Isaiah referred to the Babylonians before? Well, obviously they knew of the Babylonians. In fact, he did. If you just turn back a little bit in chapter 39, they were mentioned. When Hezekiah was ill, they sent a present to Hezekiah, 39 verse 1, from Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon. And there's a warning in that chapter that Babylon are going to get closer to Israel than what they really wanted. So yes, the nation of Babylon, people of the Chaldeans, certainly was a people known at that time. But verse 14 of chapter 43 is pretty remarkable, isn't it? Verse 14 is saying, in explicit language, that God's going to bring down Babylon for their sake. You know, the higher critics say, don't they, that there's such specific reference to Cyrus here, that therefore the second half of Isaiah is going to be put up there at the time of Cyrus. Because otherwise it would make any real relevance to the people to whom it was speaking. What a lot of claptrap. The very point of prophecy is that God has spoken before it came to pass. They say, look, he even named a man, never does that anywhere else. What about the prophet that came, the unnamed prophet that came and mentioned the word Josiah in 1 Kings chapter 13? What about it? Who said he never does it any other time? And what if it hadn't been done another time? What sort of an argument is that? What relevance would it have to even build anything upon the fact that already happened if it was given in the days of Cyrus? What value would that be? None at all. The whole point is to say it before. Say what will happen. Like here. For your sake I have sent to Babylon and have brought down all their nobles and the Chaldeans whose cries in the ships. Now that's going to be relevant, isn't it? And there would have been people listening to Isaiah and saying, goodness sake, what is he ever talking about? Is he saying that he's going to bring down Babylon for us? What's Babylon got to do with us? The only thing Babylon ever had to do with us, they brought us a present when Hezekiah wasn't too good. But you see, later on they'd see the enormous significance of that. When, in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon came down and took their city and their people, they come back to a passage like that and they say, it won't last forever. And Isaiah is complimented by Jeremiah, who says in chapter 25 and chapter 29, only for 70 years. So there was a whole story built up, and the story's beginning in Isaiah, of how God will bring down Babylon in their turn. So it's got absolutely every relevance with his argument. His argument is, I said it before, I did it. Now he's saying, I'll do it again. I'm telling you now, I will do it again. I was Yahweh through that period of time. I will be Yahweh your Redeemer through this period of time. Never changing. There is no other Saviour but me. So that's rather thrilling, isn't it? What about this statement? I have down all their nobles and the Chaldeans whose cry is in the ships. Because that seems a funny sort of expression, people have played around with the translation a bit, but the word ships, what I can make out, is in the original. And so I suppose the question is, well, did Babylon have anything to do with ships? And they did. If you turn to the 51st chapter of Jeremiah, in verse 13, it indicates that Babylon was related to the seafaring peoples. O thou that dwellest upon many waters, abundant in treasures, thine end is come with the measure of thy covetousness. Now how come? Well, do you remember the large river that ran through the city of Babylon? And the walls spanned both sides of the city, didn't they? So the river Euphrates ran through the city. Well, what the Babylonians did in their very large walled area, which I just forget the size, it was very large. It was 15 miles by 15. What does that make? 15 by 15 is what? 225? Is that correct? It's a very large area, isn't it? So what they did was run off these little canals from the river Euphrates on both sides. And so out down there, 3 or 4 kilometres down there, there was a man making his weaved baskets. Another lady was making her special dresses or her materials or whatever. And they could put those on the little boats, and they could bring those out to the main river, and they could put those on the vessels, and they would take it down the Euphrates, out through the Persian Gulf, and then, well, wherever the ships of Tarshish might like to take them. So they were on the trade routes. When later the Persians came along, they tried to do the same thing, actually built a canal that would reach to their city, so that they could therefore do something of the same kind. But that 51 verse 13 illustrates that Babylon always had relationship to the seafaring powers. In Isaiah chapter 23, another evidence of it. In Isaiah 23, this landed people nevertheless had close relationships with the seafaring trading powers of the time. Isaiah 23 and verse 13, behold, the land of the Chaldeans. This people was not, till the Assyrians founded it for them that dwell in the wilderness. They set up the towers thereof, they raised up the palaces thereof, and he brought it to ruin. How, ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. ships of Tarshish. Who was their strength? Babylon. Obviously related to it. Babylon was the great and rich power, so much of the trading, the profitable trading that they entertained was related, of course, to Babylon. Now, not to stop, but quickly look at Ezekiel 27. Do you remember? Ezekiel 27. Very recently in our readings. It's all about the trading powers of the world, or about the trading of Tyre with all the different powers that were in the world at that time. And, of course, the power of Babylon and the areas around Babylon were related to that trading power. So there's three passages that show that Babylon was, in fact, related to the seafaring exercises of the maritime powers of that day. Isaiah 43 verse 14 therefore stands in its own right. The Chaldeans, whose cry is in the ships. Now, as we mentioned, there are other references in Babylon. This is well before Babylon's supremacy. Well before, notice that, well before. We looked at chapter 39. Can you remember another chapter earlier in Isaiah which mentioned Babylon? 13, that's right, John. Chapters 13 and 14. Just try and put this into a context. Just perhaps jot these down in your margin, because it shows that although he's well before the supremacy of Babylon, yet he has a lot to say about it. Chapter 13, the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see. It goes on to say how the Medes would destroy, verse 19, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency. Chapter 14, as we often point out, is a proverb against the king of Babylon. So chapters 13 and 14 are about the same power. Now if you swing back to the other side of Isaiah 43, look at chapter 46 verse 1. Bel boweth down, Nebo stoopeth, their idols were upon the beasts and upon the cattle, your carriages were heavy loaden, they are a burden to the weary beasts. Now we'll come by there perhaps next year and work all that out, but they're the gods of Babylon. So chapter 46 is a chapter against Babylon, and how the verse 11, ravenous bird from the east, the rapidly moving Persian Cyrus would eclipse the glory of the Chaldees' excellency. Chapter 47, yes, it's about Babylon again. Verse 1, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon, sit on the ground, there is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate. Now that's when she was just a third-rate power. So she... Here's Isaiah speaking. Babylon has to grow and increase in strength, number, and military victories until it becomes number one. And then when it becomes number one, it takes Israel and encompasses Israel within its hold. And then after a period of time, not specified by Isaiah but later by Jeremiah, after that time, God releases Israel from her hold. That's the prophecy in Isaiah. So there was a lot involved in those statements. For your sakes I have sent to Babylon and have brought down all their nobles. So the great and mighty princes of Babylon were going to be brought down so that Israel, for Israel's sake, so that they might be redeemed. So here was a classic example. If people bring up the objections of Deuteronomy, they really take away from the Bible much of its glory, and that's a very tragic thing. And it's a tremendously valuable thing to us in everyday life, isn't it? It keeps us going all the time, doesn't it? As we're going about in our daily life, and all the pressures are upon us at work, or wherever you might work, or wherever you might go, whatever you might be reading or looking at, or noting the drift of mind of people in the world, and you would keep trying to keep away from that, and to keep our mind upon the right things. It's the fact that God has spoken and he's fulfilled it that so often gives strength to our resolution, isn't it? There is no question of that. Because in another very rich way, we have become his witnesses. We know what it says. We know what he did. And therefore, we know we'd be fools to walk away from that position which has been proven by God. So, how important it is to get that straight. I am Yahweh, your Holy One, the Creator. You didn't exist without me. The Creator of Israel, verse 15. I sit supreme in your midst. Your King. And now verses 16 to 17. Delightful and rich, which thus saith Yahweh, this wonderful, glorious, all-powerful Creator and God and Redeemer and Saviour. Thus saith Yahweh, which maketh a way in the sea and a path in the mighty waters. Past tense? Well, it was. But this isn't past tense. He'll do it again. That's just what he's saying in this very chapter. He'll do it again. He did it then, he'll do it again. That's the guarantee that he'll do it again because he did it in the past. Which maketh a way in the sea and a path in the mighty waters. The springboard of their present faith is the fact that he has fulfilled his word of the past. He bringeth forth the chariot and horse. There's Pharaoh tumbling into the Red Sea, a token of God's integrity and faithfulness to his people. The army and the power, they shall lie down together, they shall not rise. They're extinct, they're quenched as tow. And if that's brought, therefore, in the context of verses 14 and 15, look out for Babylon, because what happened, therefore, to Egypt is going to happen also to Babylon. Do you remember Ezekiel again? What was their reading we had just the other day that was exactly the same as that? Remember Ezekiel chapter 31. Exactly the same idea. In Ezekiel chapter 31, God gives a lesson to Egypt from the downfall of Assyria. And he says Assyria was this majestic tree that was above all the trees in Eden. See, the highest nation in the world. Now he says, Egypt, you better look out. Because what happened to Assyria? So Assyria becomes a lesson for Egypt, see? Now that's exactly what we've got over here in Isaiah chapter 43. Babylon, rising in ascendancy, look out Babylon, remember Egypt. What happened to Egypt is going to happen to you. I'm an unchanging God. The same thing therefore will come upon you as came upon them of old. Now verses 18 to 21, I've headed up a new thing. It's a little phrase, which is in verse 19. I will do a new thing. It's intriguing, isn't it? What does God mean? Verses 18 to 21. Remember ye not the former things, neither consider the things of old. He's moving on. Another chapter's going to be introduced. You could go back to those things and go through it all again, but God says, look, for now, I want you to look ahead. I've got a new program. Something new. Something different. I will do a new thing. Now it shall spring forth. It's about to sprout forth. Shall ye not know it? I'll tell you what it is. I will even make a way in the wilderness. But he's just done that, hasn't he? In verse 16 and 17. Well, I'll make a way in the wilderness. There's no ways in the wilderness. You don't find roads out in the wilderness. You can take the plane over Africa and you can fly for thousands of miles in Africa and look down, there's not one decent road in the whole thing. You don't find ways in the wilderness. God says, I'll make one. Fly across Australia. How many ways do you see? You don't. Just endless stretches of terrain. But God says, I will make a way in the wilderness. A well-known trodden path in the wilderness. We'd never expect, not enough people to worry about it, but I will make a way in the wilderness. And rivers in the desert. You find rivers running down through the middle of Australia? Well, you might if you're lucky and get there in time after a big flash flood, but you don't normally find them, do you? But he's saying, I'll make rivers in the wilderness, in the desert. Well, in other words, he's going to do something which is a complete reversion of that which has been. And he amplifies that in verse 20. The beast of the field shall honour me. The dragons and the owls, aren't these unclean creatures? This beast of the wilderness out there in the desert is honouring God? Indeed, this is a complete reversion. Because I give waters in the wilderness, picking up the phrase again from verse 19. There's a complete reversion. And rivers in the desert. That which was useless and barren and dry and totally devoid of growth and happiness. Now there is streams and rivers flowing through the place. It's been turned into value. I give waters in the wilderness, rivers in the desert, to give drink to my people, my chosen. What? Beasts of the field and dragons and owls? They're unclean. What is the prophet saying? It can't be something that was in the past, can it? Because he says, I do a new thing. What do you think he's saying? Somebody would like to have a stab at that? What's he saying? What is this about? Put those little factors together. New thing. Something different to the past. A complete reversion of that which was. Absolutely. It's really got to be that when you think about it. He's not talking about trees. He's not talking about water. He's talking about that water we've been learning about from Brother John in John chapter 7. That the water of life. He was the water of life, wasn't he? And now what he's saying here in verses 9 and 19 and 20 is that he has another people. And he has another chosen. That are made up of the incidental beasts of the field. And the dragons and the owls. Has he used that language before? He has. And here's where it comes from. It's in the 34th chapter. In the 34th chapter, when the kingdoms of the world are turned to naught, and their princes cannot be found, verse 12, they shall call the nobles thereof to the kingdom, but none shall be there, and all her princes shall be nothing. Who occupies their former state of exalted position? And thorns shall come up in her palaces, nettles and brambles in the fortresses thereof. And it shall be a habitation for dragons and a court for owls. The wild beasts of the desert shall also meet with the wild beast of the island. And the satyr shall cry to his fellow, the screech owl also shall rest there and find for herself a place of rest. There shall the great owl make her nest and lie and hatch and gather under her shadow. There shall the vultures also be gathered, every one with her mate. Has Isaiah suddenly turned into a bird lover? What's he talking about? He's not doing that, is he? He's talking about a people that God is going to find in nations that hitherto were lost and vulgar and unclean. And it's like Acts chapter 10, when all those unclean beasts were in the four-cornered linen sheet that Peter saw when he was in prayer. And he was told to go and eat them. And he said, no, I can't eat that which is common and unclean. Never done it in my youth. God says, call not that common and unclean which I have cleansed. And here he is. Here's the process of cleansing. It's in Isaiah, in exactly that same language. This is just an interlude, as it were, or it's a preface, as it were, to Acts chapter 10. And in chapter 43, then, he's developing that further. See? A new thing. A new thing. In Ephesians chapter 3. He speaks about this as a not quite as a new thing, but as something that was not seen. Yet it was there. Quite clearly it was there. How that by revelation, verse 3, he made known unto me the mystery. Skip the next, verse 5, which in other ages was not made known unto the sons of men, as it is now revealed unto his holy apostles and prophets by the Spirit, that the Gentiles should be fellow heirs and of the same body, partakers of the promises in Christ by the gospel. That the Gentiles, verse 8, should receive the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to make all men see what is the fellowship of the mystery, which from the beginning of the age hath been hid in God, who created all things by Jesus Christ. And so Paul was enthused by the opportunity to go out and spread this new thing, which had not been seen, now was seen. But it was in Isaiah. And really, when you think about it, coming back to our 43rd chapter, there was nothing else that those words could mean. A complete reversion was what was involved. Now, we're going to fill that out in just a moment, but just to give you a couple of other passages which show that it's already been kicking over. Isaiah 41. Verse 18, the same language, same figures of speech, same description. I'll open rivers in high places. Don't find rivers over Mount Lofty, do you? I will open rivers in high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. Make the wilderness a pool of water, the dry land springs of water. I'll plant in the wilderness the cedar, beautiful trees, straight and beautiful. In the wilderness. Don't find cedars out there in the Nullarbor, do you? How many cedars did you see when you go across the Nullarbor? Well, he's going to see cedars across the Nullarbor. What he really means, if we were to sort of relate it down, he's going to find people that love the hope of Israel and love the God of Israel in Australia. That's what he's saying. Or in the lands of the Gentiles, any other place. Russia, Ukraine, Byelorussia, Nepal, all these other places. There will be people who love the hope of Israel, love the Bible. The hope of Israel and the God of Israel in all the nations of the world. That's what he's saying. Where were we? Chapter 41, verse 19. Plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittah tree, and the myrtle, and the oil tree. I'll set in the desert the fir tree, and the vine, and the box tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of Yahweh hath done this. Once it was only Israel that could see and know and consider and understand. But now all those other trees, the trees of the Gentiles, the cedars of Lebanon that he had planted, they too will be able to see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of Yahweh has done that. My dear brothers and sisters, that's your record and mine in the scriptures. That's how God thinks about it. It's a lovely new thing that he's done. But none of us were related to this, weren't we? My people came from Cornwall or somewhere. Didn't have any idea of these things. Locked up in all the ignorance. No knowledge of it. And so on. You could all go through your own passages. We all came from different places, didn't we? Totally unrelated to the hope of Israel. But God in his wonderful mercy has brought that to us in a very wonderful way. So we rejoice, therefore, in that sense of verse 21. Isaiah 43. This people have I formed for myself. They shall show forth my praise. Now that's a very pertinent statement because that's echoing verse 1 and verse 7. I created thee, O Jacob, and formed thee, O Israel. Call thee by thy name, every one, verse 7, that is called by my name, for I have created him for my glory. I have formed him, yea, I have made him. This people, made up of the beast of the field, and the dragons and the owls, this people have I formed for myself. they shall show forth my praise. So when we think of what God has done in our lives, we really need to be very grateful, and using that gratitude to be inspired to respond to his goodness towards us. Now, if that's the case, and it's a new thing, then what's happened to Israel? Well, in the following verses, 22 to 28, we have the fall of Israel. It ends up in verse 28, "Therefore I have profaned the princes of the sanctuary and have given Jacob to the curse and Israel to reproaches." So this is a very meaningful chapter. It started with God saying that he created Jacob, formed Jacob, redeemed him, called him by name, "Thou art mine." It finishes by saying, "I have profaned the princes of his sanctuary and have given Jacob to the curse and Israel to reproaches." What happened? Verse 22. "But thou hast not called upon me, O Jacob. But thou hast been weary of me, O Israel. Thou hast not brought me the small cattle of thy burnt offerings. Neither hast thou honoured me with thy sacrifices. I have not caused thee to serve with an offering, nor wearied thee with incense. Thou hast brought me no sweet cane with money, neither hast thou filled me with the fat of thy sacrifices. But thou hast made me to serve with thy sins. Thou hast wearied me with thine iniquities." I didn't wish to weary you, verse 23. Not so at all. But you've wearied me. What was the problem, my dear brothers and sisters? Did it mean that they hadn't brought their small cattle in the prime of their youth and their fatness? Did it mean that there were no burnt offerings? They certainly did have burnt offerings. This is Hezekiah's day, remember? Hezekiah's day, he's speaking. There was a lot of religion there. But unfortunately, it was still going to be much like chapter 1, the opening chapter. There was a lot of religion in the days of Isaiah. Isaiah 1 verse 11. Remember that long statement, verses 11 to 15, about all the activity that was happening at the temple. I'll just run through it very quickly so you get the picture. Everything was going in the temple. It was a going concern. "To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices? I am full of the burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts." Fed beasts, they were the best, brought by the stall and fattened up. "I'm full of it, and I delight not in the blood of bullocks or of lambs or of he-goats. When you come to appear before me, who hath required this at your hand to tread my courts? Bring no more vain oblations. Incense is an abomination unto me. The new moons and Sabbaths, all the special days, I cannot away with it. It is iniquity. Even the solemn meeting, I'm sick and tired of it," says God. "Your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hateth. They are a trouble unto me. I'm weary to bear them." It's very similar, isn't it, chapter 43? You must link those two together. It's chapter 1. Later, it's chapter 43, but it's identical. There was the same lack of spirited desire in the service that they rendered to their God. I'm not sure whether it means that they had not brought the small cattle of their burnt offerings, because the other one says that they brought their fed beasts. You know how Malachi says in his first chapter, he says how that they were bringing the worst of their flock and of their herd. They were bringing that to God. In Malachi 1 verse 13. "But ye have profaned it," verse 12. "The table of Yahweh is polluted, and the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible. Ye said also," verse 13, Malachi 1, "behold, what a weariness it is. And ye have snuffed at me, saith Yahweh of hosts, and ye brought that which was torn, and the lame, and the sick. Thus ye brought an offering. Should I accept this of your hand? Now, they obviously were bringing, you know, the worst that they could find. No, you were taking it to market, so you take it to God, so to speak. But I'm not sure, really, in Isaiah 43, if that's what was happening. I think it's to be read like this. Verse 23, thou hast not brought me the small cattle of thy burnt offerings. Oh yes, they brought them to the temple, but God was a long way off. And that's what he bemoans. See verse 22, thou hast not called upon me, O Jacob. God was not really a joy to them. Their service at the temple, well, you had to go and do it because everybody did it. And he had to look right. But their heart wasn't there. Thou hast brought me no sweet cane with money. But obviously they were bringing sweet cane with money. Buying it, yes, no trouble. Neither hast thou filled me with the fat of thy sacrifices. But chapter 1 said they did. But I think that's the sense. It wasn't brought to God. And that sense of serving but not with their heart, not in faith of God. See the point? Brings him to say in verse 25, I, even I, am he that blotteth out thy transgressions for mine own sake and will not remember thy sins. My dear brothers and sisters, what you're reading is a historic statement on Israel's fall through the works of religion that lacked faith. God is a tangible, loving, wonderful, real and powerful Redeemer that loved them, was not in their lives. It had become a performance. I, even I. So it was like the Pharisee that came and, you know, the Lord's parable says he came and prayed with himself thus, God. So he hadn't got out of himself. In all the things he'd done, he could reiterate them, tell you from where to go, all the things he'd done. But God wasn't there. Very religious, but God wasn't there. I, even I don't need all this stuff that you bring. I blot out thy transgressions. I come and I wipe them out. There they were, and I wipe them out. And you look at the slate after, and they're gone. What did that? Because you brought sweet cane with money? Because you brought all the fat offerings? Because you brought all the best of your flock? Is that what took it away? What, you can bring that and not come to me? Not see your need of me? And therefore that will take them away? Never. I blot out those things. If you think you can bring all that to my temple and have this parade of religion and yet you don't come to me, those sins will remain. The blood of bulls and of goats will never take away that writing that is there. But you come to me with your heart. You call upon me and I'll blot those transgressions out of the book. That's what he's saying, isn't it? Even I am he that blotteth out thy transgressions for mine own sake. I would do it for my sake, because my holy name's sake, because I've called you, I want you. What a beautiful thing to say to a people. It's not just your salvation, I want you. I want to save you. And will not remember thy sins. Won't be a remembrance every year. I'll just take them away as far as the east is from the west. How far is that? How far is north from south? Well, there is a north and there is a south, but where's east? Tell me when to stop. It just goes, doesn't it? As far as the east is from the west, so hath he taken our transgressions from us. So he says, in the same sense of wanting them to come unto me, put me in remembrance, verse 26. Put me in remembrance. I've said I won't remember your sins, but remember me.
Come to me, call upon me. Let us plead together. A loving and wonderful God that wanted to redeem. Declare thou that thou mayest be justified. In other words, declare your desire to come to me. Not declare your righteousness, not at all. The opposite of that. In the sense of, thou hast not called upon me, verse 22. Come with all of your heart. State the situation and you will not find that I will falter. Thy first father hath sinned, and thy teachers, thy interpreters have transgressed against me. It's been the story of your nation from beginning to end. And this now is going to go right through to the time of the Lord Jesus. In the time of the Apostle Paul, when he'll pick up this doctrine of justification by faith, by seeing God and knowing God and calling upon him, not displaying all before him what we've done, that he therefore might justify us, but by our need of him and calling upon him in faith, he will take away our transgressions, because we love to serve him, because we love to come on our Wednesdays, because we love to refresh ourselves. Isn't it a beautiful thing? We're not in Romans, are we? Galatians, where these things are expounded in greater and more explicit detail. We're in Isaiah. Salvation of Yah. The same principles are all there, aren't they? Just like a little piece of Romans tucked in Isaiah. The principle of justification by faith. And Israel did fall on that very principle in Jesus' day. That's exactly where they were. And so the temple was profaned, verse 28, and its officers as well, its princes, the princes of the sanctuary. And Jacob was given to the curse by the Romans, and Israel to reproaches by the world into which they were scattered. And why? Because they didn't serve God with all their heart and with all their soul. Tremendous things, really, aren't they, my dear brothers and sisters? They really are. And as we go home to our homes tonight, we've got to measure up alongside that and say, well, where's our own heart? Do we love him? Do we love to serve? We have our little ups and downs from time to time. But do we love him? And do we call upon him? Do we love to serve? Is this the place that we love to be? Is it a weariness sometimes to say, oh, it's Wednesday night again? Or do we say, yippee, it's Wednesday night again. I'm off to Bible class. Is our Sunday night attendance just a little bit tired sometimes? Or if we're doing a few other things, seminars and interested friends, classes, so on, is that all that become a bit of a weariness? Or do we rejoice in the fact that we are about quite a few different things? And that life is busy in the truth. Isn't it a lovely thing that life is busy in the truth? I mean, what else would you want to be in? Would you want to be in something you sort of give the fag end of your life to it every now and again? There's no joy in that, is there? But we've been called to something that really can use every vestige of our abilities and our time and our interest and our heart. And we can find there in that a loving God who wants to save and to be our Redeemer. My word, we are blessed.